Jai Om Vishnu Pada, Panamaha Sahara, Vajarya, also Dada, Sadashi Shimad, His Divine Grace, Abhaya Chalanahad, Abhakabananda Goswami, Maharshila Prabhupada, Jai. Iskan Founder Acharya, Shila Prabhupada, Jai. Kunti Boishna, Vrindiki Jai, Navacharya, Shila Haridas, Thakur, Jai. Prince Ego, Shri Krishna, Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shidwaita Gadaha, Shiva Siddhi Gaur Bhaktivedanta Jai. Shri Shri Radhakrishna, Gopika Vanaha, Shyam Kunda, Radhakunda, Giri, Govardhan Ki Jai, Vrindavanam Ki Jai, Mathuradam Ki Jai, Jagatvasami Ki Jai, Nimunamai Ki Jai, Srimati Vilasi Devi Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakta Vrindavanam Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasadaya Shri Prabhupada Swami. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravati Pachari Devi Shesha Shinivadi Paschacha Deja Tarane. So, Tumananda Shaganjana Shilatea Chakshur. One many time, Yena Tosmai Shigurveda Maha. Okay, so I think we'll keep it non controversial today. I was going to be more controversial, but I'm not going to be. Because you have some very sensitive devotees here. Anyway, I was going to talk about ethical dilemmas, which are very interesting. So, but I'm not going to talk about them. So, even though I want to, I'm choosing not to, because I value having devotees listen to me and not run away. So, anyway, so let's talk about the blocks of communication, or the 4 D's of discommunication. How about that? Which two did we talk about so far? Does anyone remember? Nobody remembers. What's a diagnosis?
Labeling.
Like, give me an example.
Like someone is a rascal, or some scientist or fool is a rascal, or something.
Okay. What about the scientists are nice?
It's not so historical.
I'm offended by that statement. So, because that's my background. Anyway, so to give someone or something a static designation, because every one of us, every living entity is not ecstatic, but every living entity is dynamic. We're dynamic living entities. You put a label on us and it just makes us static. Understand? Just like, I mean, let's take your friend Hitler, for example. What label would you put on him?
Demon.
Demon, okay. Because he did a lot of things that were really bad, right?
Yeah.
But he's a vegetarian, too.
The monkeys are also vegetarian.
What's that?
The monkeys are also
vegetarians. So you call them a monkey. Anyway, so if you were just like his family member and saw him as a vegetarian kind to, you know, his dog and everything, you probably wouldn't call him a demon.
Yeah.
So he had different facets to his as hard as that may seem to understand, he had different facets to his personality, right? Or let's say Ravana, he's less controversial. Ravana, along with Jarasandha and all these nice Vedic demons, were actually quite hospitable to Brahmanas. So they had a certain side of them that wasn't so bad. So it's better to see them as spirit souls who are, I mean, using Krishna consciousness, spirit souls who are bewildered by Krishna's external energy. You know, that's really more accurate. They're bewildered by Krishna's external. They're not, and also they're not inherently demons because they can be rectified by the process of Krishna consciousness. Here's an example. What would you call someone who kills people and steals from people? That's his occupation.
Murderer and a thief.
Murderer and a thief. Okay. So there's an interesting story in the Ramayana about Valmiki, who's the author of the Ramayana. And he was actually exposed by the Sapta Rishis to his potential karmic reaction. And as a result, he went to his family to see if they could share that karmic reaction. You all know this story. And he said to his wife, "Can you share my karmic reaction?" She said, "No. Your job is to steal and give me the money." And he went to his son and he said, "No, your job is to steal and buy iPhones for me." Something like that. And so then he went back to the Sapta Rishis and he was given the mantra Mara Mara to chant, and he chanted Mara Mara, and then he became such a great devotee. So if you just put this static label on him, that he's a rascal, he's a demon, he's a thief, he's a dacoit, he's a gunda, I mean, these are Indian labels, of course, then you won't see the potential. And his potential is to be a great devotee. And he did become a great devotee, not just the potential, he actualized his potential. So these sort of labels interfere with us giving Krishna's mercy to people. One practical designation we can see is a designation that Prabhupada very much appreciated, and he praised the great Christian saint, Saint Francis of Assisi. He said to see everyone as a brother and a sister, because that's an eternal designation. That's true always in all places and all circumstances. So we can apply labels, but labels that are absolutely true, that don't change according to time, place, and circumstance. So we're not against any sort of diagnosis or label, but we want eternal labels. Spirit, soul, part and parcel of Krishna, my brother, my sister. So the preacher sees like that. If the preacher sees in terms of labels, the preacher won't be able to preach or share Krishna consciousness. Right?
What about the statement that the second-class devotee does sort of label people?
No, he understands practically, it's not a label. Mm. He understands practically, don't approach people who have the philosophy who are, don't want to hear about because they're not receptive. Mm. Just, you know, it's practical. Mm. But he has to be careful in applying that. Like one time I was in the airport along with some book distributors, and one of our main book distributors, and I was just with him trying to understand how he was distributing books, and he said, "Here comes a sweetie." And that didn't mean a lady, you know. Not that he was a brahmachari, still is a brahmachari. But that meant someone who actually was a nice person. So you don't want to get to that point thinking that someone who can take a book, someone who can give a donation is a nice person, someone else is not a nice person. It's just that someone would be more receptive to accepting Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, you're shutting someone out. And you're giving it's not a good designation. It's just that you may think that here's someone that I don't have the potency to bring to Krishna consciousness. But a great devotee like Srila Prabhupada could bring that person to Krishna consciousness. And that's actually why, you know, it's interesting, going back to the story of Raghunath Das Goswami, when he was at the Sinhadwara gate begging for food, you know the whole story? He gave that up and went to the kitchen for poor people to distribute food. Because he was starting to see in terms of the designations. You know, here's someone who will give me food, here's someone who will not give me food, here's a nice person, here's a not so nice person. So that was interfering with his pandita samadarshana. Yavidya vinaya sampane brahmani garihastani shunichaya swabhakicha padita samadarshana. That they learn in gentle sages with equal vision a dog eater, an outcast. Vidya vinaya sampane. Brahmani, a Brahman, Gavi Hashtani, Shuni Chaiva, Swapati Chaiva, means a dog eater, Pandita Savadarshan, he sees equally. So, Krishna consciousness and empathy means to develop equal vision, become a Sama Darshi. In other words, to see everyone, not to imitate a Mahabhagavat, but to see everyone as part and parcel of Krishna, as my brother and sister. And then you. As we mentioned yesterday when we were quoting from that verse in the Yashu Upanishad, anyone remember what the number is?
Six.
Yastu sarvani bhutani atmana ivana pashati sarva bhuteshu chatmanam tatona vigigukshate. The one who sees everyone as part and parcel of Krishna does not hate anyone or anything. Very important verse. So, when we start applying designations, then we start hating certain people or rejecting certain people. So it's very important to get away from these designations and diagnoses. However, we should be aware when someone does something demoniac. Like if we see someone eating meat, that activity is demoniac. Right?
Yeah.
The activity is demoniac. But the person's not a demon. So let's go back to your friend Hitler. His activities were demoniac. That's easy to understand. But he could be rectified in the future. Some future birth. He might become a great, that's hard to understand, that he might become a great saint, a spiritual master, an acharya. Isn't that amazing to think about that? By the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, a lame man can walk, a dog can swim an ocean, or a blind man can see, right?
Yeah. Cool for Donald Trump, too.
Well, Trump is not as bad as Hitler. So, of course, he might have been, had he had the power. You never know. You put power in someone's hands, and it really corrupts people, because that's a designation. They identify with the power, with the position. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine how someone like Hitler or Ravana or something could become a great acharya. But who is Ravana anyway? Ravana is one of the two Jaya Vijaya. But by the but look at Valmiki. Mm-hmm. He became a great saint. I mean, such a great saint that Sita Devi was able to stay in his ashram. Mm-hmm. And he took care of Lavan Kush, the sons of Lord Ramchandra, and taught them the Ramayana. Mm-hmm. He's one of the great saints of all time. Mm-hmm. And he was killing people. He was killing people. Maybe not on a large scale like Hitler. But he was killing people. I mean, amazing. And Jagai and Madai, okay, let's go to Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. It's ascribed that their sins were so voluminous that Chitragupta, who's Chitragupta?
Secretary of Yamaraj.
Yes, the secretary. His computer became overloaded. It's described. Yeah, anyway, described. Yes, scribe means people write things down. I'm sure they have computers there. I mean, how could you keep up with all the rascals without a computer, right? So, it's described that the volumes about Jagai and Madai sinful activities could fill a bottomless pit. Bottomless pit means there's no bottom to it, and it can fill it. That's a description of Chaitanya Mangalam, Chaitanya Bhagavat. And yet, they became great saints by the mercy of Lord Nityananda. So So if we were just seeing them as like rascals or demons or, you know what, and actually certainly they were killing people, they were raping ladies, you know, something that was really bad. And they became great saints and associates of Lord Chaitanya. And then of course you have the prostitute, Haridas Thakur's disciple. And she just came to Guru Haridas Thakur. So if you just look at her, you know, prostitute. You know, people put all these designations, you know, and then of course those who are rascal conservatives, they have the sexist designations, you know, because of the body, you know, the ladies who are less intelligent, right? Then would you tell your wife all about that?
An iron imprint on it.
So, because people are looking at these designations, but Sarvapati Vinayabhakam. Anyway, so anyway, we were just talking about that block, the diagnosis block. So it's really important to see things, not simply negate the diagnosis, have the right diagnosis, right? Mm-hmm. Part and parcel of Krishna, brother and sister. Instead of thinking, get away with the diagnosis, you can actually take a positive. Like I oftentimes talk about the you know, 10 offenses on chanting Hare Krishna in a positive way. You know, so you have the first offense is what? The blasphemy of the devotees of the Lord who have dedicated their lives to propagating the holy name of the Lord. So instead, take it as a positive. Because if you always think of it negative, you can't, you know, I learned this, of course, in nonviolent communication. You can't do it, don't. And the example they gave was, don't think of a pink elephant. I said, this is an order. None of you should think of a pink elephant. Don't do it. And immediately the thought of a pink elephant comes into your mind. Yeah, I'm thinking right now of a pink elephant. No, I want to get it out of my mind. It's like a brahmachari who's trying to get the brahmachari news out of his mind. Don't think of it. Because you can't do it. You can't do it. Don't. So so you can't not commit offenses against devotees unless you're dead. So what you do is when you see a devotee, you praise them, you serve them, right? Omanina, what? Manadena. Not having any, you know, false prestige, and be ready to offer respects to others. So you do the opposite, and then it automatically takes care of the negative, isn't it? It's automatic. Oh, okay. Think of any of the offenses like that. Offenses on chanting. Like to think the names of the demigods are equal to or independent of the holy name of Lord Vishnu. That's one that only Adi Purusha is subjected to. The rest of us don't have that problem. You know, here in his room he has Ganesh and Vayu and
Indra.
He has an altar with 80 million demigods. Anyway, so instead you see them in their right perspective. Not that you think, oh, those horrible demigods, you see them as part and parcel of Krishna, they're servants of Krishna. And you respect them in that way. Because also, the acharyas say that it's also offense to disrespect the demigods. That's another way they explain that particular offense. So the point is, you're not supposed to consider them equal to or independent, or their names equal to or independent, the holy name of Lord Vishnu. But you're also not supposed to think of them as just, you know, demigods, you know, rascals or whatever. They're servants of Lord Vishnu. So that's the point. I'm not going to go through all the 10 offenses. That's for an initiation class. But the point is to do a positive. Give a positive designation. You know, so if I say, don't think of, picking on you again, don't think of Adi Purush as a male. Don't think of him as an Indian. Don't think of him as a devotee. Don't think of him as a student. You're left with a void there, aren't you? If you don't have any, isn't it? You're left with a void. Don't think of him. So instead, do a positive. Give you a positive diagnosis. You know, if you're a good doctor, you give a good diagnosis. So we're not against diagnoses, we just want the diagnoses that actually are true. And that's one thing that I've never heard that in nonviolent communication about true diagnosis. Maybe some teachers teach like that. But when I was with Marshall, he was talking about the Buddhist understanding, because he's a Buddhist. At least at that point, he was a Buddhist, a Jewish Buddhist. It was interesting. So what I'm saying... Actually, it was interesting when I did this really intensive with Marshall. We did... He let me do a whole session in past life regression. Yeah, and I made a lot of friends from that. See you with a dhoti in your last life. And I was your guru in your last life. I didn't do that. That would have been not proper. So anyway, so you have a positive. So all right, so the diagnosis, we're getting that out of the way. You see everybody's part and parcel of Krishna, brothers and sisters. Then you really have compassion. Because when you see everybody connected, you know, we're talking about, isn't it, empathic connection, empathic compassion, and nonviolent communication, which is a negative anyway. So then we're talking about connection. So how do you have connection? By having the right understanding or the right diagnosis. Brother, sister. Brother Adi Purush. And as I mentioned, Prabhupada said that's first class God consciousness when he was talking about St. Francis of Assisi, who considered the plants, the animals, to be all brothers and sisters. That's a wonderful consciousness, isn't it? And we were walking this morning, we saw some brother dogs barking at us. Of course, you know, it takes some time to think like that, because I was just thinking, this nonsense, dirty dog. I gave him a designation, because he was barking at me. Fortunately, here in Slovenia, you keep the dogs outside in cages. In America, you walk, the dogs come out at you on the road. It's serious. And in Fiji, I actually got attacked by a dog. You rip my dhoti off and everything. Yeah. I still have a scar. Anyway. So, it's interesting. Actually, one of the ways you criticize someone, you say that they're just a dog. Right? You know, sometimes a man doesn't like a woman. She says, she's just a dog. You have that saying? Gracious? Anyway, so... What? Yeah, worse. And of course, what do we have in the Bhagavatam? Those that were like hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. So we really, you know, you have to be able to balance these things. So And the verses, those are like hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. Don't glorify Krishna, they glorify those who are not Krishna. You know. So, Shastra Chakshus. So we have to think that you're acting like a hog, dog, camel, and ass. You're not a hog, dog, camel, or an ass. So we have to really understand how to take those injunctions. Otherwise, we could never reach out to people. I remember there was one devotee good friend of mine, and he passed away, but he would go out in Sankirtan, and he would just accost people and said, "You're like a hog, dog, camel, or an ass." And that's pretty heavy, isn't it? Mm. If you tell people that. Of course, people don't understand what camel means. We understand, because the camel chews what? The thorns. And it enjoys the blood from the thorns. Ass, they understand. Hog and dog, they understand. So, how do you apply these shastric injunctions? You know, the shastric statements is one has to have the intelligence. That's called hermeneutics. That they're acting, like I described how Prabhupada would call people rascals. Just take it, Prabhupada is saying, he's acting in a rascally way. He's acting like a dog. He's acting like a hog. He's acting like a camel. He's acting like an ass. But he's not an ass camel. He's part and parcel of Krishna. He's my brother. Like, if you see your brother, someone who you really identify, someone you really love, and he's doing something that's destroying his life, like for example, let's say your brother or mother or something is drinking. Not water. Cerveza. None of you know cerveza.
Yes.
What's cerveza?
Beer.
Beer. That's Spanish. Actually, it's interesting, because my name... You know, sometimes I run into people who are drinking beer, and I said, you know, you should associate with me. My name is Spirit Krishna. Easy name to pronounce, you know. And one of my godbrothers called me Cerveza Maharaj.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, it's Beer Maharaj. So anyway, so let's say someone you really love has an addiction to drinking. You don't see them as a beer drinker. You shouldn't. You should see them as my parent or my brother or sister, and they're suffering. So it's really important to have the proper designation. I love them and they're suffering. I want to take them out of the suffering. I want to bring them to their constitutional position, because if you see them in terms of the designation, your compassion will be stilted or will be interfered with. Okay, let's go back with the second block of communication or D of discommunication. What's the second one we talked about?
Denial.
Give me an example. Well, not you, because you weren't here. Who wants to give us an example of denial responsibility?
I eat too much because prasadam's too good.
Yeah, you're blaming the prasadam.
You made me angry.
You made me angry. What's another one?
I cannot work because it rains outside.
You cannot what?
I cannot work because it rains outside.
Sometimes it's true. You know, if you have certain construction work, you may not be able to work because it's raining. That is true. I can't chant my rounds because I'm upset. I can't chant because I'm in Maya. So you're blaming Maya. I mean, there's like that story that Prabhupada told. Once upon a time, the king asked the sage, "Why is Maya so strong?" This is very much connected with denial of responsibility. And the sage actually ran up to the pillar and he embraced the pillar and said, "Let me go, let me go." So he was blaming Maya for being in Maya. But actually, it's us that are embracing Maya. So we can choose. We have free will. Okay, diagnosis. Oh, let's go on. So let's... With the diagnosis, denial of responsibility. And here's a big one. The next one I've been talking about is demand. So, it's not that we can't ask things of people. You know, I can ask, so I'm always picking on these two. Anyway, so I get asked to leave the Sundari to cook for me. And it may or may not be a demand. What does anyone know what, how to distinguish between whether it's a demand or not?
You're not ready to accept a no?
Yeah, right. I'm not ready to accept a no. And be happy about it. Or she may get some repercussions. But in other words, my mood should be what? Actually, I'm testing all of you when I'm asking her to do it.
Make a request.
Yeah, but what is the mood? You try to paraphrase the model.
It fulfills your needs.
If you are willing. If you are willing to do it, then would you be willing? And then she says no, I said okay. But in order to actually be in that particular mood or that particular mode, one has to be thinking of alternative strategies to fulfill. In other words, I have to be thinking that if she doesn't cook, I have some alternative strategies. Because if I don't have alternative strategies, and I'm not going to eat, I'm not going to be a happy camper. So I have to be thinking, in other words, ready to do it myself, if necessary. Or ready not to eat. Or ready to, you know, just take Krishna's will. Accept Krishna's will. And that's a very sweet relationship, where people are doing things from their heart voluntarily for you. I know personally that I don't want to eat anything that someone cooks, that they, while they're cooking, if they feel that they have to do it. And guess what? Krishna has the same mood. If you're doing deity service and you're thinking, I have to do this service, you know, like this, and just let me just get it done, I can't guarantee that Krishna's going to accept it. Because Krishna says, what? Any verse from Bhagavad Gita? Yome bhakta priyachati. One should offer me voluntarily, I'm adding some words to it, with love and devotion. If it's not done voluntarily and happily, there ain't no love and devotion. A prerequisite for love and devotion is voluntary action from one's heart. Ritualistic behavior has no love and devotion built into it. If it's simply ritualistic. Or a sense of duty. You know, it maybe have a tinge. You know, this is my sense of duty. I'm supposed to serve my spiritual master, but I'm doing this because I'm supposed to do it. And if we see the process of devotional service as a demand, we become disconnected from Krishna. This is really important. It's not just like someone's asking us to do something or I'm asking someone to do something, but we've been given the process of sadhana bhakti. And if we see that Krishna's demanding that we chant 16 rounds every day, demanding that we wake up early, demanding that we offer our food to him, demanding that we read Srimad, we have to, you know, have to do that, which is demand. Anything you think of like have to is like a demand. Then we're not connected at that point. So the process of devotional service has to be acted joyfully. And not hear these things as a demand or have to do it. Anytime you hear this, have to do it, it's a demand. And it encourages rebellion because we have this need of autonomy. Just like I was talking to some parents the other day, and they said, our child is now 2 years old. Our child is in the age of terrible twos. do. She won't do what we want. You know, terrible twos. But terrible twos is actually a wonderful age because the child is expressing its autonomy. So when we demand something of someone, they have two options, either to submit or to rebel. And the point is with children, if you demand obedience and they submit, I mentioned this in my book, they eventually lose. Let's say you're making them obedient about certain moral principles or spiritual principles, and they submit, they lose their sense of moral compass after some time, ability to decide for themselves. And when they get older, because they're always, not always, but they're generally submitting to what they consider to be authority or association, then later on their friends become their authority or association, and they submit, and they don't have the moral compass to understand between what they consider to be right and wrong, or proper behavior and improper behavior. So, anyway, so demands are very, very dangerous. So the question is, what's a spiritual master to do if you can't demand things? You're in trouble. Anyways. You know, you got the, why am I doing what I'm doing? The whole reason I became a spiritual master is so I could demand things from people. Terrible, isn't it? You can't even go to a disciple and say, yeah, I'm your guru. You got to do what I say. This is worse than being a boss in a firm. Because at least a boss in a firm, you have some repercussion. You fire them. You can't fire disciples. You have to be compassionate. You have to be compassionate. Anyway, it's a difficult situation. No, actually, it helps develop a very sweet relationship with people when everything's based upon free will. And people voluntarily giving from their heart, because that's really what we want. So anyway, so that's my end. And so the final, yeah, question about that.
I'm just reflecting what you're saying, and a management. this is very important for managing.
You're talking about managing a company or something.
A company or...
this is not a method of management. Yeah, you weren't here the first few days, the first day. I was mentioning that in ISKCON, I firmly believe that our structure is counterproductive in many ways to Krishna consciousness. Sorry about this. Counterproductive to Krishna consciousness and counterproductive to good management. It's the worst of both. Why? Because it's really opposed to Varnashram. Because in Varnashram you have different people acting as Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Can you imagine in your firm, you're the boss or what?
No, I was actually thinking about
the temple. ISKCON. Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's talk about your workplace.
Okay.
You're the boss, or?
No, I'm not. We work in the NGO of devotees,
okay.
But I'm not the boss.
You're not the boss. Too bad. So, let's say you had a boss in your firm, and your boss happened to also be your guru. Let's say, you know me. Let's say, I was working for the NGO, and I'm your boss. Would that be a problem?
There could be a conflict of interest.
Yeah, there could be. Could be. And I say that this particular thing has to be accomplished by tomorrow. And you're thinking, I can't do it. But you're thinking, if I don't obey my spiritual master, it'll be a mad elephant offense. Of course. None of my disciples look like that. They just think, you know, they just think, he's so good, but we can get away with any damn thing.
Oh. I know how they think.
Well, we have liberal. Yeah, he's really liberal. You know, the one that he was conservative. I'm just paraphrasing the thoughts going on. Anyway, so, but it's a conflict. It's conflict. We're in the temple. What we described the other day was the temple situation where the president is supposed to be the mentor of all the devotees or the spiritual shelter of all the devotees. Is that a conflict or not?
Yes.
It is. In most cases. Unless, if you're like Prabhupada, you can wear many hats and be perfect at it. But for the rest of us, rascals, there has to be the vision of duties. Because what I'm finding lacking in most temples, and this is not a criticism of any particular temple here, any temple anywhere, is that devotees don't feel that they have someone that they can really go up to and trust and just reveal their minds to, who doesn't have any other interest other than their spiritual life, who's not really, you know, concerned, you know, wants them to do service, but he's not really in anxiety about who's going to do the next arti, who's going to cook the offering, or anything like that. So, you know, because people need, you know, there's management. Empathic communication is not a management technique. You don't use it to manage people. You know, if you're willing to do your job, would you be willing? Doesn't matter, I'm going to give you your salary. Whether or not you show up for work every day, you could take a vacation for 3 or 4 months, and you will still get paid. You had a boss like that, it'd be pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah. But in a sense of, let's talk about ISKCON, where nobody is actually, well, in some cases they are receiving salary, but in this particular, nobody's receiving salary, nobody's actually doing getting something in return. This sense of engaging in voluntarily service, it doesn't exist. I mean, in Zagreb, it doesn't exist.
The sense of engaging
How to say that you're engaging somebody and his free will and that he is doing this voluntarily.
It doesn't exist.
I mean, I'm over exaggerating, but there's like, if you don't do service, you're Maya or you're not good and things like that. But I mean,
yeah, well, that's called domination culture, which we dealt with the first day, and it creates a situation that ultimately people don't stay.
Yeah, they're not inspired.
Yeah, they're not inspired, and you get what's called a revolving door effect. You know, people serve for some time and they get fried out and they leave after some time. So Krishna consciousness or serving Krishna has to be based on inspiration. You know, just like what I'm doing, I'm not getting paid for what I'm doing. But you know, I'm inspired to do it, I'm inspired to associate with devotees, I'm inspired to help people become Krishna conscious. I mean, I didn't have to come here to Europe to make money. You know, actually, I'll give you another funny story. It's like I go to Fiji, I meet a lot of disciples in Fiji, and then when I initiate people, the average reduction is about $5. It's not a very good business. You know, you open up the envelope and it's five. Well, the equivalent, 10 Fijian dollars equals 5 American dollars. So, you know, so what am I getting out of it? You know, I'm doing my work out of inspiration. What's that? Thank you.
Yeah.
See, what a good disciple. Very good disciple. What did I just do?
Diagnosis.
Diagnosis, and when you use diagnosis, it can be very manipulative. Good boy. Bad girl. You know, it's extremely manipulative. When you use this good, you're bad. You know, it's... When you appreciate someone, you appreciate... All right, let's give an example of how I should have acted. I should have acted when you gave me the cushion. Thank you very much for giving me the cushion. I appreciate it because it met my need for having a soft seat. Not having an aching back or whatever. And that's it, you know, appreciation. But if I did, all right, let's compare the two. If I say, good girl, how do you feel if I say good girl?
Nice. I don't know.
You know, just blah.
Yeah.
Basically, you'd be blah. Or you, what a good disciple. How do you feel when I say that?
I am still like, oh, that's nice.
It's nice, but it's, you know, blah.
Yeah, I did something right. I don't know. Like,
yeah, but if I, because now we're going a little further into empathic communication, if I say, thank you very much, you know, just like my back was aching, it wasn't, but anyway, if I say my back was aching and you noticed it, I really appreciate how you let my need for a comfortable seat, and you were empathic enough to notice it. How do you feel if I say that?
Like an exchange. It's more
of an exchange. You feel more encouraged, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's empathy. Instead, you know, we have to really be careful not to just like say good boy, good girl, good disciple, bad disciple, nonsense, rascal, jackass, you know. So okay. Where were we? What?
You
want to ask a question.
Yeah, about inspiration.
Yeah.
I don't know if I said this question rightly, but who is responsible for the inspiration in authorities?
No, ourselves.
Yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to find inspiration. Okay. And also, I don't want to use the word authority. See, we have this thing in Krishna consciousness that it really irks me. Like you go to a devotee and they say, who's your authority? Someone asks me that, I go, ah! Krishna! Prabhupada! You know, of course, because it's... I think that sort of wording really leads to like a domination culture, isn't it? Who's your authority? I mean, who do you coordinate your service with, I think would be more appropriate. But I think as adults, I mean, maybe I'm just too crazy. But too empathic or something, or too touchy-feely. So, but when you talk about authority, it just like makes me want to scream.
Hmm.
I don't know if it has that effect on you.
Yes.
Now that I mentioned it. Yeah. You know, it's like ingrained in our ISKCON consciousness.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
And we're talking about it like the devotees who are leading our temple, we call them authorities.
I would say they're the ones who are leading the temple. And they're the authorities of the temple, yeah. I think that's proper. However, just the word authority, and maybe it's just my own prejudice. If I have to refer to the word authority in terms of me, it's not that the GBC temple president should be running the lives, especially the devotees outside the temple. running the lives of the devotees. What do you think?
Yeah, it's kind of no, but they do.
But we recently found out that by the Eastern Law book, actually the temple leader is in charge for the congregation also.
Oh, well, in charge.
In charge to proper thing to be that he serves.
He serves. He's a servant leader.
Yeah.
He serves to help facilitate Krishna consciousness. And, you know, even I think of my position as guru as a facilitator rather than a boss. I mean, just the word boss, authority. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm American. just to think of authority. I just think, you know, someone who helps me in my Krishna consciousness, maybe guide me. No Krishna consciousness, but just to have someone assigned to me as that person's my mentor. Okay. It's hard. Prabhupada wanted independently thoughtful people in our Krishna. You know, we facilitate, we associate, we take guidance, but authority to me indicates like micromanagement. Control. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah.
When you use that word, at least to me, that's what, you know, as an English, native English speaker.
It's very hierarchical.
It means basically authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, facilitator, guide, in charge of the temple. Fine, you know, I'm all right with that. But authority and dictator are very close to each other. Like, just substitute the word, he's my dictator.
Yeah. Yeah.
Use a synonym and see how it feels. It's a synonym. Yeah, what's that?
In connection with this thoughts that were now mentioned, authority and inspiration, so on. I see somebody who inspires me.
Yeah.
I see him as a leader.
That's good.
And there are many devotees who inspire me for when I see what they do.
Right.
Not that I will do the same that they do, but
yeah,
I
but
get inspired.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to help them in such case. If I see that they do something that inspires also me, they ask for help, I'm willing to help.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa. Somebody does something that doesn't really connect with me, I'll have more difficulty to serve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in this way I also see if somebody who would like to put oneself in a position of authority, I see that you can have whatever position you want, but if you would like my wholehearted service, you have to inspire me.
Yeah.
With whatever you do.
Because it's voluntary.
Yeah, because it's voluntary. So at the same time, I understand that some inspiration has to come from inside.
Yeah.
With chanting Maha Mantra, with connecting with Krishna. But then we come to this conflict. Somebody has a position, he wants it or not, doesn't matter, but he wants some service to be done, which it may be difficult.
Yeah.
If he doesn't inspire you.
Yeah. When you're dealing with a voluntary organization, it's very difficult. And one has to be able to choose the people who inspire him. You can't just have them given to you. This person should be your inspiration. It has to be someone who really, it's a choice. It's a free choice. So getting back to the point about management, I'm a firm believer that there has to be a manager in each yatra, and then also an inspirational person in each yatra. You may not be inspired by the inspirational person, you may be inspired by the manager. But in general, the inspirational person has to be someone who has no other interest other than encouraging people in the process of bhakti and encouraging people to cooperate with the manager too, from inspirational viewpoint. And if you have someone like that, and I did mention the first day when you weren't here, that many of the churches in America, they have a division of labor like that. There's actually a minister who has nothing to do with the finances of the town, of the church. Nothing to do with the management of the church. He's just maintained by the church. He's given a little parish house right next. I don't know if it's the same thing here in Slovenia, but he's given a little parish house right next to the church. And his whole business is just to minister to the congregation. You know, he, of course he gives his service on Sunday, but he's not thinking, if I speak this way, people give this much donation. If I think speak that way, and people give that much donation, because he's not connected at all. So it's sort of a very nice situation, and I admire that. And that's pretty much what Varnashram is. Brahmana and Kshatriya. You know, because like the Brahmanas, they were controlled by the Kshatriyas. I mean, the Kshatriyas were controlled by the Brahmanas, sorry. Maharaj Yudhisthira or Lord Ram, they always have these Brahmanas that they refer to. And they took advice from the Brahmanas. So, because when you're in a managerial role, you think in a certain way. And that's also, you know, it's a conflict of interest that I have to deal with on a daily basis, because I'm in a managerial role. Traditionally, Prabhupada didn't want sannyasis in managerial roles. He wanted them out preaching, but when he found out there was no one else to do the management, he brought them back, especially to Mal Krishnamaharaj, to do the management. Okay? Does anyone else have any question about that inspiration? Or?
Well, I'm wondering if all sannyasis are Brahmin. I guess they are Brahmin.
Supposed to be. Yeah. A sannyasi is ultimately supposed to take on the position of Brahmin, a teacher. A sannyasi, according to the Varnashram system, is supposed to be the guru of all the other varnas and ashrams.
Well, in Tamal Krishna, that case, he was really good at management.
He was great at management.
So it would have made sense for him to be in the position of a manager, but he was a sannyasi.
But he was great at being a sannyasi, too.
Yeah.
He was fantastic. He was good at both things. Mm-hmm. So. But when you're trying to do both at the same time, that's when you end up in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can do management, yeah, I'm not going to say I'm good at it. But, you know, I don't mind doing it. Because
mm-hmm.
I like controlling people. Subjugating people. Bow down, Mr. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. That song goes. No. I'm pretty good at, you know, especially financial management and other things like that. And that's why we have the temple in North Carolina. However, I do find a conflict having to do both things with the same individuals. I do find myself a conflict situation. That's why in the temple of New Goloka, which you've experienced, I more or less stepped out of management role. Although, you know, I'm managing our university preaching. And I'm saying, you have to do this, Raja Leela. You're the preacher!
No.
You have to do it! You're the
yes, sir.
Peon. So, yeah. Anyway, I am able, in that situation, to balance it.
I have a question. Like, I've noticed in Slovenia, like, the temple is much more, people are much more connected to, like, the temple and the management, but for most of my Krishna consciousness, I mean, I was, like, part of the congregation, but, like, I don't really see the temple being such a big, like, part of my, like, Krishna consciousness for a large part. Is it, like, necessary to be, like, heavily involved with the temple, or, like...
I think what everyone is inspired to.
Mm.
However one is inspired.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in your Krishna consciousness, you're mostly working with the university outreach.
Yeah, it's mostly like, sort of, I mean, I come on like Sundays, help out every now and then. It's not like...
Yeah, so, not to pat myself on the back. I think we have the ideal situation there where people fit in wherever they fit in. Therefore, most or a lot of our deity worship is done by the congregation. Mm-hmm. Because people feel inspired. We don't have to pay salaries to anybody. Our finances are like no problem at all at the temple because the congregation... I mean, recently, just... Let me just talk about that. We just had a Panihati festival. And the congregation, in order to sponsor different pots, not pot. Yeah, I got to be real careful. Despite, you know, these different pots, Panihati, you know, chip rice, you know, condensed milk, pots that they would decorate. So the congregation basically sponsored so many that they gave the temple like $10,000 worth of pots. And because it's all volunteer, they're feeling inspired. Because the system we've set up there is like an inspirational system. That, you know, we have no trouble getting our deity worship done. The temple president's inspired. We have a temple leader, a temple president, or a congregational president. We sort of divided up the services. Another devotee named Aditya Narayan. And he just manages that. So there's nobody really trying to control it, anything. And people come, like, we have devotees come to dress the deities in the morning and travel 45 minutes in the early morning to dress the deities. Because they're inspired. You know, it's just like, we want to do it. You know, I talked to this, one of the couples, and I said, you know, we can give you some service in your local area. And they said, no, don't take away our deity service. Because they're inspired. So, I mean, it's not that we're perfect, but things are based on, we try to keep things based on inspiration rather than, you know, authority. And people seem happier, like, you know, Adi Purusha is engaged in university preaching, and Rajalila will be engaged in university. And they're inspired. You better be. Telling you to be inspired. You know, you're here at the Amaraj. That's where I send disciples who are not inspired. I have a direct connection with it. So, anyway, so ultimately, if we want longevity in the devotees, it has to be based on inspiration. Because bhakti is inspiration. It's not force. It's not salary. It's just like, you know, I really want to serve Krishna, I want to become Krishna conscious, I love Krishna, I love my spiritual master, you know. Like what I'm doing for Prabhupada. I'm inspired to serve Prabhupada. And that's where, you know, I'm inspired to help all of you. You know, it just inspires me. It's my life. I mean, even today, I came out at 10 o'clock because I thought we were going to start at 10. And I was inspired, you know. Anyway, so... any other questions about inspiration?
Yeah.
So the word mentor is also...
I think mentor is good. It's not necessarily bad. It's a question of how you define it in your mind. You know, this person guides or inspires me or in Krishna. Because we do need association. We do need association. But it shouldn't be forced upon people. And sometimes someone who's our mentor may not serve in that capacity after some time. That person may not inspire us. And we may seek another person that inspires us. Or we may seek someone on the internet who, you know, some devotee on the internet who inspires us by his or her preaching. Why not? Why not? I mean, we shouldn't be possessive. I mean, I have some disciples who are inspired by some other guru a lot, you know, Sikshi Guru. It's not great. They're becoming Krishna conscious. They don't belong to me. And there's disciples, you know, initiate disciples, other gurus who are inspired by me. Great, we're all one family. Isn't there's no question of possessiveness. You belong, you know, it's like this typical marriage thing. When people get married, they say, I'm yours, and you're mine. Oh my God. It's scary. You possess the other person. You know, so we shouldn't have this sense of possessiveness that this person belongs to me, or the temple president owns this particular person, the guru owns this particular person. It's not like that. These are loving. We should have loving relationships and be concerned about the person. Whatever is good for the person's spiritual life, material life too, meeting the person's needs should be done. So that's demand. No, management's a different thing. If you're working in a company, and if you don't go to work, you don't get paid. There's a saying in Chinese, no tiki, no shirty. I don't know if you know what that means. Okay, that's in English, of course. But in America, we used to have these Chinese laundries, and when you gave your shirt to be cleaned at the laundry, you got a ticket, you know, that identified that shirt as belonging to you. And so if you didn't have the ticket, you couldn't get your shirt back. So in Chinese, it's no tiki, no shirty. So you have to be practical. You know, you own a laundromat or, you know, a Chinese laundry. And someone doesn't have a ticket, you're not going to just give them something. Oh, that's my shirt. So there's practical management, too. You know, you're running a firm, you got to produce. You got to produce. And so management is management, and empathy is another thing. And they can both work together. As we mentioned the first day, you have ombudsmen or ombudspeople. Or HR directors and things like that in corporations, they're supposed to be more empathic. You have conflict resolution people. Just like we have in ISKCON, we have devotee Braja Bihari, who's in front of, who's in charge of conflict resolution in the movement. So we do have conflicts. And he and there's another devotee, Brahma Tirtha, you may have heard about. He's the one with the perfect questions, perfect answers. An old friend of mine. And whenever we have a conflict, not whenever, but you know, frankly every day, they're working 24 hours a day. I mean, yesterday we had a conference between them and the anti-VDG people, you know, Vaishnavi Dikshaburu people. And so Brahmacharya is trying to mediate, trying to keep us from killing each other. And then we have, there were other ones about different conflicts that Braja Bihari is working on that we have. Anyway, so many different conflicts. I was involved in a conflict because there's a project in the United States that wanted to close because it's impractical, and the devotees didn't want to close it, and so Braja Bihari had to mediate between me and them. It was a managerial conflict. And that's part of mediation. It's called ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution. And so you need people like that. So any other questions about inspirations, perspiration? Yeah. Holiday. Holiday, yeah.
There are many groups or individuals around the globe who are in ISKCON and they would like to do some service in their own way, maybe different, and they don't find a way to engage in some existing projects or temples, and they're inspired to do things, which is rather rare to say like that. It's not that everyone are super inspired. And what do we usually do to inspire such people to just keep their inspiration going on, so that they're somehow within ISKCON, but still that they are?
Well, you have to see what inspires them and engage them if it's compatible with our objectives within the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. I mean, like distributing prasadam or something like that.
I mean, this should be be, of course, in line with, but
yeah.
Sometimes it happens that, let's say, I know here in Slovenia, sometimes it happens that people who would like to do things to serve Krishna and very in line with these kinds are sometimes not encouraged or they're even discouraged to do service. Or,
Can you give me an example?
There was a group recently who would like to be to serve devotees, also to do preaching.
Yeah.
I mean, in line with Bhagavad Gita, with Krishna consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But they somehow didn't get in line, they didn't have good connection with local authorities, and they were discouraged basically to continue their service.
I don't really want to get into the local politics here. I think that's something I don't really want to get into, but that's why, let's think of general. In general, we need a division between Brahmins and Kshatriyas. I'm firmly convinced about that. People have fought me about that for many years. But we need people who, let's say, that group can relate to, in general, this is not specific about your situation, a group like that can relate to, go to, feel some empathy from. And that group, or those devotees who are just like more Brahminically, well, I won't say more Brahminically inclined, but those devotees who have that particular service can communicate with the managers. And once you have that, I mean, like we have in ISKCON, we have, you know, someone has a complaint, they go to alternative dispute resolution. We have this all the time. And someone goes to the ombudsperson, like Raj Bihari or whatever, and things have worked out. And so we need that on a local level, too. Because these conflicts will happen. This is not unique. What you're experiencing in Slovenia is not unique to this particular country, this particular situation. But you need someone who people can go to and take shelter of. And that those people will, because they have no managerial position, can relate to the authorities and somehow or other, you know, work things out. And it's an absolute requirement because conflicts are always going to arise. Conflicts are natural. They're not bad. I mean, I took a course many years ago. This is not non-violent communication. And conflict resolution or conflicts. And we were taught that conflicts are good. It's a question of how you deal with them. You know, people have different opinions. One of the things we learned in this conflict resolution course is that we were shown different pictures. And everybody thought the picture meant something different. And who was right and who was wrong? Because we have different points of view, different perspectives on things. So, and it's really important to respect other people's perspectives on things. That's why we need political input. To be able to, you know, someone who's detached, not involved in management, because management is necessary. Without management, everything falls apart. You know, I'm not decrying management. It's absolutely necessary. Prabhupada stressed it. He said our movement will go on because of good management, intelligence, and Krishna consciousness. He was asked by Giriraj Maharaj. Giriraj Maharaj asked him, is the movement going to go on? And Prabhupada said, I think it was Giriraj Maharaj was asked the question by Prabhupada. And Giriraj Maharaj answered, if we're Krishna conscious, then Prabhupada said no intelligence in management. So management is absolutely required. And managers will always do things that will disturb other people. That's the nature of management. But you need the mechanism in place to resolve those conflicts. There's no manager in the three worlds who's going to please all the people all the time. It ain't going to happen. I would say at least 25% of the people in any situation are going to be disturbed by what a manager does. Even the best manager in the three worlds. So it's a question of how to resolve the conflict. Not to avoid conflict, but to resolve conflict. Okay, who has any... So we touched upon the four D's of discommunication. Oh my God, it's getting... When you're having a good time, things are going fast.
But do we do dessert?
What? We did deserve it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because that's part of management. You deserve it to be punished. Yeah.
So what role actually has congregation then in toward the management? Can this be somehow left?
Well, the congregation will sometimes agree with, different members of the congregation will sometimes agree with management. This I'm talking theoretically, not about any particular country. And sometimes they'll disagree. But there has to be part of the, not exactly management structure, but the structure of the yatra has to be someone or a group of people who are simply brahmanas, not involved directly in management. And these brahmanas are friends with both the management and the congregation. They're just, they have no conflict of interest. No conflict of interest. They have nothing to lose. Like Chanaka Pandit. You find Chanaka Pandit, he was actually the advisor to the king. And he disagreed with the king, but because he was living in a hut, not taking a salary, he could just say, you know, hasta la vista, which is Spanish for goodbye. So, because he had no conflict of interest. If I'm taking a salary from you, I have a conflict of interest. If I'm dependent on you, I have a conflict of interest. Like if a disciple, if a guru is dependent on a disciple, that's a conflict of interest. You know, without you, I would never be, without Adi Purusha, I couldn't preach. My life would be useless. Which is crazy. So, anyway, but you find that sometimes, you know, if you're overly dependent on another's mercy, it actually takes away your brahminical qualities. If you have, in other words, this need for autonomy is really important, because if we're overly dependent on anyone, it creates a demand on the other person. And it also keeps us from being able to express our autonomy, our self-worth and everything like that. It's really bad. Unless one's like completely disabled or something like that. Like I know I have a response. Sometimes people try to help me in different ways. Like if I'm carrying my bags, I say, let me carry that for you, Guru Maharaj. And I'll say, no! Because I have a real strong need for autonomy. Mm. I can do it myself. Because of that need for autonomy. So, if we're... actually, this is a statement in Shastra. If we're overly dependent on another's mercy, and we're not talking about the guru's mercy or the spiritual mercy coming from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but overly dependent on other people, other than the fact that we may be disabled, which is a different situation, then it takes away from one's sense of autonomy, and it also takes away from one's brahminical vision. So we should be ready to do things. We should be ready to be able to do everything ourselves if necessary. And then you're not going to be demanding things from people. If you're ready to do things yourself, ready to seek out other alternatives, then your relationship is very nice. Like, I have a pretty good relationship with Adi Purusha. Have I ever demanded that you do something? Other than getting married to your wife? Yeah.
Not that I can think of.
No. He's supposed to be a disciple, but anyway. But I never really demanded the whole time. Or at least to Cynthia, if I ever demanded anything. Mm-hmm. No. I'm not going to ask Rajalita to collect. No. I mean, I can go around to everybody. But I don't think I've ever demanded anything from any of these devotees. And therefore, the relationship's sweet. Because I don't. I mean, it's just not my nature. because I'm not dependent on them. Not dependent, you know, you can all just like disappear. Not really. But I'm not dependent, I'm not emotionally dependent, I'm not financially dependent, I'm not physically dependent. I'm going to take care of myself. You know, obviously if I was in a situation where I was disabled, it's different. Yeah. Stipend.
Stipend or something?
Yeah.
What are the downsides?
I think the devotee's needs need to be met. I mean, that's a really interesting question, one that is controversial in ISKCON right now, you know, about salaries. Prabhupada was against salaries. There's actually letters where Prabhupada didn't want the devotees, especially in Los Angeles. And it can create a fruitive mentality. And I've seen in certain temples where they actually have like a punch clock. I'm not going to tell you which temples. Punch clock means you punch in at a certain time and you punch out at a certain time. And if it's not your time when you punched in, you know, so what? The deity service is not getting done. That's someone else's responsibility. So it can create that sort of mentality. However, at the same time, devotees need to be maintained. So if devotees have some need, like their car needs to be repaired, or something like that, then certainly the temple can pay, you know, car needs to be repaired, insurance, they have to, you know, some health insurance or something like that. I think that, you know, these are needs that any dependent devotee, any devotee who's working full time, has to be taken care of. I mean, otherwise, there's an implicit relationship between the temple or the yatra and the person that, you know, we're going to be taking care of you in the case of a brahmachari, and the needs have to be met. Yeah.
I've heard in some cases, like, there'll be brahmacharis, and then, like, they'll, I don't know, do traveling sankirtan, and the whole time they're like giving all the money to the people who are their authorities, and then when it's time for them to like enter grihastha life, like because all the time they've been earning, they've given all their money away to this authority, like they're sort of kicked out and then on their own, and then they don't have enough like finances to really.
They should get it from their wives. yeah, so there has to be some arrangement, a devotee. Let's take another case, like in Mayapur, these devotees are serving their whole lives doing sankirtan.
Yeah.
And now they're like 60 years old.
Mm.
So obviously, it's the movement's responsibility to make arrangement for these people to, you know, have their needs. You know, they're not married.
Mm-hmm.
Their needs have to be taken care of. So, yes, this is the management responsibility.
Mm.
Someone is serving, and you've taken service of it. It's not like a tissue you blow your nose into, you throw away.
Yeah.
So brahmachari is not a tissue that you blow your nose into. And you just throw them away after you've squeezed every little bit of service out of the person.
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, yeah, there has to be a responsibility towards the person. I think that's really important. I mean, just like in Nuvaloka, we have some older people, like, you know, Chintamani.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not throwing her out.
Yeah.
I mean, she does practically nothing at this particular point. Prema, you know, Chintamani. I mean, she's old, she can't function very well. You know, she comes to the temple and putters her out a little bit or something like that. But we never throw her out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our responsibility to help her live her old age.
Mm-hmm.
And be Krishna conscious, be an association of devotees.
Mm.
So there has to be responsibility on management part.
Does ISKCON has a strategy, like global strategy, to take care of an elderly?
I think it has to be done locally.
Okay.
Because most people are going to want to live locally, you know, around where the devotees they like. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, send everybody to Mayapur where they can be all stuck together. But most people, this also applies to hospice, too. which I've said, hospice means when people are getting ready to die. Most people want to be around the people they live their whole lives with. So, for example, they made this hospice in Vrindavan, and basically it's been empty most of the time. Because devotees, they don't want to... Most devotees, when they're getting ready to die, want to be around the people, you know, their family. People, you know, they don't want to be with people they don't know. I mean, it's kind of hard. I mean, even if you're getting full-time service, like you send them to the hospice. We had one devotee who went to the hospice in Nadi. You remember Nadi? Yeah. And it was hard for him because he was around people who he didn't know. But of course, nobody in our area could take care of him because he had certain issues. But, so, my feeling, I mean, this is just my own personal opinion, I'm not thinking it's absolute, is the local yatras should make that adjustment for people who've been serving that yatra. Prabhupada, in one sense, was against too much centralization. I mean, I certainly, when I retire, I want to be around the people that I've been serving my whole life. I don't want to, I mean, I love Mayapur, I love Vrindavan, but I'd like to be around the devotees, you know, who've been with me. I mean, it's part of human relationships. So, I remember when my godbrother Jayananda was passing away, he passed away in Los Angeles. He could have gone to Vrindavan. He had leukemia. Prabhupada had him stay in Los Angeles and be surrounded by the devotees who really loved him. And we all loved him. I mean, I was there at that time. And he passed away in such a situation. So, but it is the responsibility of the organization, yes, somehow or other, whether it's centralized or local, that we have to have facility for the devotees who have dedicated their lives. Because, you know, we talked about that first offense, blaspheming the devotees who have dedicated their lives to preaching Krishna consciousness. Well, neglecting the devotees who have dedicated their lives to preaching Krishna consciousness, I think it's pretty much the same thing.
Mm.
Yeah, so you have a question?
No, it's just a comment, but therefore it's also so important to develop loving relationships between the devotees while you are still there, because there are places, unfortunately, where devotees are served together to deal like strangers.
Yeah. Yeah, because those loving relations, especially when you get older. When you're young, you don't give a damn about loving. Oh, sorry. It's just like, you know, the promontory. You're in Maya! Love! Yuck! Then, I mean, if you use that word amongst the brahmacharis, this is like... One brahmachari says to another, I really love you. Maybe you don't belong in the brahmachari ashram. I didn't know you had that propensity. So, but I think more and more the devotees are just becoming normal in this country. That's from my experience. You know, we do have love between people. Love doesn't mean, you know, you're just like a sexual type of thing. It means that you love the devotees. I mean, I love my disciples. I love everybody. And it's just, you know, just life. You know, with love, it has all these repercussions to, you know, these insinuations from that word. So, I mean, it's interesting because my disciples regularly, you know, on the text messages, they send me hearts.
Oh.
If that had happened like 40 years ago, I would have run to the Himalayas. You had a, yeah. A heart from a female disciple. Oh my God. So yeah, it's extremely important because life is miserable without those close connections and relationships. And that's ultimately the inspiration. You know, the connection is the inspiration. Connection between people. I don't think it's an inspiration so much, you know, I just want to be Krishna conscious. That doesn't mean anything to me. to me, it always involves people. You know, I want to help certain people become Krishna conscious. I want to please Prabhupada. I want to please, you know, of course, I also say I want to please Krishna. You know, Krishna. You know, Krishna. I want to please Radha and Krishna. You know, because I do have a relationship with Radha and Krishna. So you know, so all this is relationship, sambandha. And so, to me, that's what inspires me. Not the idea of winning the Sankirtan Marathon or having, you know, making a lot of money. Well, sometimes driving a nice car inspires me. But anyway, not really. It's dry after some time. Material things, you know, such pleasure has beginning and end. That's mode of passion. In the beginning it's like nectar, in the end it's like poison. But with connection and relationships, in the beginning it's nectar, in the end it's nectar. This is really interesting, isn't it? Of course, in the beginning sometimes it's a struggle to establish relationships, but it's the real happiness that we have. It's the real inspiration. And that gets away from demands, because we were talking about demands. Demands are the opposite of that sort of inspiration. You take inspiration on one side and demand on the other side. Inspiration is voluntary from the heart. If you're willing from the heart, inspired to do this. And promise, that's our movement, goes on by loving relationships. Didati prati granati kriyamakyati kruchiti bhute bhojyate chaiva. That's from the Nectar of Instruction. Accepting prasad and giving prasadam. Giving gifts, accepting gifts, and revealing mind, and confidence, and hearing from others and being confidential. That's all part of relationships. So, who else has a question before we go on to the next topic, if we have time? Any other questions?
Yes, I mean,
yeah.
But it's connected to the previous class. Like, the devotees pray that the people don't, like, suffer, you know, like Jesus Christ or...
Yeah.
But, like, my question is, so, like, devotees' compassion is actually that they suffer because they see others suffering because of their conditioning and, like, lacking of Krishna consciousness.
Suffering?
Like, the preacher, like, feels pain seeing how conditioned people are. But,
That pain is actually pleasurable.
Yeah, yeah. But my question is, why do they pray for them to, like, not get the reaction and not for them to, like, learn and change their consciousness? But
I think that's implicitly built into not getting the reaction.
Uh-huh.
It may not be stated by Vasudev Dad, who you're referring to, I think, indirectly, who's saying, I will accept the reaction of all the living entities so they can go back to Godhead. I think it's pretty much implicit that they ain't going back to Godhead unless they change their consciousness, too. Because if you find yourself in the spiritual world and you haven't changed your consciousness, you're not going to be happy there. You know, Krishna's the center, everyone's serving him. What the hell am I doing here? You know? So I think it's pretty much implicit that he's also praying that they be Krishna conscious, that they realize their real self-interest.
But isn't it easier to, like, learn if you do go through these lessons, like reactions?
Easier for some people, yeah. I mean, for some people, it's required they have to go through that, yeah. But for other people, we get the mercy of Krishna's pure devotees.
They can just understand
it. Yeah. I mean, look at Narada Muni. Okay. Let's take Narada Muni and your friend Magrari. You know that story? Magrari was a hunter, half-killing animals. And he was going to go through a whole bunch of reactions. But he got the mercy of Narada Muni. Not just that Narada Muni showed him his future, you know, it was a virtual reality type of experience. That he saw all the animals that were going to kill him in his next life. But he got the Bhakti Lata Bija. By getting the Bhakti Lata Bija, his consciousness change, because without that, as we mentioned in one of the previous classes, that you're really forced to act helplessly. Now, Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. You're forced to act helplessly even though you know the reaction is coming. Remember I gave the example of the cigarettes? People are forced by their modes of nature, their lust, to do things that they know are going to cause them pain. I remember the story about a person, it's a true story. He had to have a tracheotomy because he was smoking cigarettes. Tracheotomy, you know what that is? And you get a hole in your throat. You breathe through your throat. And what he did with that hole, he breathed. But he also used to take a cigarette and smoke a cigarette through that hole. So the punishments themselves, like mentioned in the first class we gave here about prayaschitta, it doesn't really get rid of the desire seed, the papa bija in the heart. One has to get the mercy of the pure devotee by the bhakti lacha bija. So it's the pure devotee like Vasudev Dutt who's giving them that mercy. Because without that, just getting free of the karma is not going to help them. It's like the elephant bathing again, you know, just being free of the karma. You know, what's the use of such a thing? You just go ahead and do the same thing. Why? Because the papa bija, the seed of sin, or the envy of Krishna, whatever you may call it, is still there in the heart. And the only way to get rid of that is to get the bhakti lata bija, the seed of love, Krishna, bhakti. I mean, we're a bhakti yoga movement, which is inspirational. It's not karma yoga, jnana yoga, hatha yoga. It's bhakti. You know, we do things because of love. I mean, the love can be there for the spiritual master, the love can be there for Krishna, the love can be there for the other devotees or the deities, but it has to be, that's all inspirational. That's what makes it so powerful. That's what makes our renunciation so powerful, because it's based on love. It's not based on negation. Like if I have these four regulated principles and I'm just thinking of the four regulated principles as in a negative way, you know, it's really hard. You know, some devotees, when they're preaching, they say, explain the four regulated principles first to people. Prabhupada wasn't like that. I mean, Prabhupada had his disciples, Shyama Sundar, smoking cigarettes and carving Lord Jagannath at the same time. And having the cigarette package on top of Lord Jagannath. Can you imagine that? You go into the temple and you see a cigarette package on top of Lord Jagannath. And Prabhupada said, what's that? Cigarettes. And you smoke them. And Prabhupada said, just smoke one less every day. You know, wow, that's powerful. And then he did that because he loved Prabhupada, not because of detachment from cigarettes. You can't do a donut again. It's like these four regulated principles. You don't present that to people at the beginning. What do you devotees do? We follow four regulated principles. We don't. We'll elicit sex, okay? Usually I do it in a very funny way in initiations. I talk about the four regulated principles, and there are a lot of guests there, and I just go real quickly and say, we have four regulated principles, no meat, fish, or egg, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no meddling. Now that I get that out of the way, let's go on. Before people can even hear what I'm saying. Especially if we have a lot of guests. It's the devotees, you know, it's another thing. But it's just like, oh my God. Like we have Prabhupada's godbrother who presented that to the Marquis of Jutland or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he said, no meat, fish, and this Marquis of Jutland said, impossible. But Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, then feed them meat. He didn't mean that eating meat was a good thing, but he arranged for meat to be fed to the Britishers who were coming to Mayapur. He made that arrangement. He rolled cigarettes for the construction workers who were building the temple. You know what rolling cigarettes, you know? My generation, we used to do that, but not with, for cigarettes. Anyway. Something else. Anyway, so. But then Prabhupada was, but then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was, you know, give them meat. That's what he said to his disciples who were preaching in the West. Give them meat. And Prabhupada allowed so many things. You know, like the cigarettes and the donut shop. You know, the donut, they would walk by and hope Prabhupada doesn't see us, you know, like that. And, you know, Prabhupada didn't stress in the beginning that it's boring, the principles. Because people will automatically follow them if one, if there's love. If there's devotion, you know. Of course, I'm not attracted to breaking it. But anyway, I mean, I follow what I'm following because I love Prabhupada. And I just, it's part of Sambandha, my relationship with Prabhupada. So it's easy. I don't follow them because they're four regulated principles. I follow them because I know it pleases Prabhupada, that's all. So that's really the point. So bhakti lata bija. So one has to get, but in order to have that devotion, one has to get the association of a devotee. And once you get that association, then you help the person grow it. You in the beginning, you water it a lot. And the person can't water it himself or herself. You water their bhakti lata bija. You don't worry about some, you know, secondary things. You know, whether they're smoking or something like that. You don't worry about that. You just water them with hearing and chanting. Hearing and chanting. And it grows. And eventually, you know, all right. They become great devotees. Like Valmiki just chanting Mara, 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 Mara. And eventually became Ram, 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 Ram. And then that was the bhakti lata bija. That's our process of bringing people to Krishna consciousness. You water it. You give them the bhakti lata bija. Hare Krishna. I mean, the first time I got the bhakti lata bija was I was listening on the radio and they played Prabhupada chanting. There was no devotee who burnt me out at that time. Devotees burnt me out later on. But anyway, that was... I always tell the devotees, that, you know, the first time I went to Hare Krishna temple, it was a horrible experience. Because they told me I was going to hell. Not, they didn't use the word hell, they used Kali Yuga instead of hell. I was going to be short, living underground, eating human flesh. Unless I join right now, the Yamadutas are coming, they're coming to, like the song, you know, they're coming to take me away, away, they're coming to take me away, they're coming to take me away, away. I don't know if you know that song.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, they were telling me this, and I said, get me the hell out of here! But I had already got my bhakti lata bija from Prabhupada on the radio. Fortunately, Prabhupada was on the radio. Fortunately, my first experience was not with the devotees in the temple. So anyway, so then I was chanting on my own. I said, nothing to do with those people. Those weird, weird people. The men were dressed as women and bowl heads. I don't want nothing to do with those weirdos. And they were too heavy with me. And when I saw a devotee, I drove in the opposite direction. And the worst thing that those devotees did to me is they asked for donations. That was that was the worst thing. One devotee, one girl gave me a magazine. Said, she said, Spree. And I said, thank you very much. And she said, now you have to give money. And to me, I'm cheating. So, then, you know, it was worse. But I had my bhakti lata bija, so I kept chanting, following the regular principles. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. I mean, there was a whole experience that I told the devotee I had with Lord Vishnu. But I won't tell that story right now. It's an interesting story. But, and then, nothing to do with the devotees, then all of a sudden, I heard Prabhupada's coming to town.